We turn to the prophecy of Daniel in chapter 7. Daniel 7, reading at verse 17. These great beasts which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. For the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, who is diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, and his nails of brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, and of the ten horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes, and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints, and prevailed against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High. The time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And the ten horns out of the kingdom are ten kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time, and times, and the dividing of time. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion, to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion, the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven, shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. And I suppose without any guidance we would do the same. May God bless the reading of his word. It must be well over 20 years ago, I think. I was in Brussels on business, and we spent a very long time one morning hammering out the terms of an agreement. I thought we were never going to reach a conclusion. But ultimately we did. We signed a piece of paper. Then my officer number took me off to lunch at his club. And as we were going in, he turned and pointed to a car. He said, you see that number plate? Well, I did, but I could see nothing strange about it and said so. He said, well, very shortly, every car in Europe or Western Europe will be bearing that kind of number plate. At the time, of course, he was roughly right, but he wasn't aware of the fact that very shortly, General de Gaulle was going to issue an instruction in France. The French cars were to bear no other distinguishing mark than the letter F. As we sat at the luncheon table, he started talking about another meeting that was going on in another part of the city. And he was quite blunt about it. He said he thought that meeting was doomed to disappointment. He gave his reasons quite logically, and as he was paying for my lunch, I couldn't reply to them in detail. I thought he might regard me as rude. But he was certainly rude about my country, and certainly not about his own. He was saying quite clearly that because of those things that he had mentioned, that meeting was doomed. to disappointment. When I left him, I took the train down to La Tournée on the border of France and Belgium. There my son, who was then living in the north of France, met me at the station. And as Englishmen usually do, we turned to the nearest restaurant for a cup of tea. Of course, we ought to have known better. If you've been to France, you know better too. You'll never drink tea in France. It's absolutely foul stuff. Anyhow, we sat there talking. My son said in a moment or two, "Watch that television screen. You'll be interested in what's going to happen." Well, he's bigger than I am, so I always do what I'm told. Presently upon the screen, there appeared a very tall gentleman with a curious-shaped nose. And he went on at great length about the very meeting that my friend had been discussing. Then he posed rhetorical question after rhetorical question. And to every question he put, he gave the same reply. The French word, no. It was, of course, General de Gaulle, and he was saying quite clearly that Great Britain was not fit to enter the European community. We were not part of Europe. We were far too insular. And for various other reasons, including personal ones that he did not mention, he thought we were completely unsuitable. Well, since that time, of course, Britain has entered. Back in 1957, Western Germany, France, Italy, Belgium, Holland, and Luxembourg joined together and signed two treaties. As a result of those treaties, there came into being two communities. The European Economic Community, or as is commonly referred to, the Common Market, and the European Atomic Energy Community, or Euratom. 6 years earlier, they had signed another treaty, which brought into being the European Coal and Steel Community. So that in 1957, there were three communities, of which those six nations were members. Each had its own commission, with its own president, a council, and so on. But today, of course, those three communities have emerged into one, and other nations have become members. Since that day, Denmark, the United Kingdom, the Republic of Ireland, and Greece have become members of the community. Other nations are already seeking to enter and possibly may become members in the not-too-distant future. But at the present moment, there are 10 members of that community. Not three communities now, but one, with one commission and one council of foreign ministers, varied from time to time if there is a special subject to discuss, and an elected parliament from the 10 nations. The parliament has very little power. It's just a talking shop, far more so than Westminster. They are seeking, the members of the parliament are seeking, greater power and authority. And it is intended by the parliament they shall have control over some of the decisions and some of the proposals that are made. At the present moment, all they can do is to approve or disapprove the budget. The real power lies not even in the hands of the Council of Ministers. The Council is composed of the foreign ministers of the 10 countries. As I said just now, sometimes they are replaced by another minister if a specialist subject is being discussed. But normally the Council is composed of those 10 foreign ministers. And until just recently, Lord Carrington, our own foreign minister, was president of that particular body. The real authority, the executive power, lies in the hand of the Commission. That is composed of commissioners nominated by each one of the 10 countries. The number representing each country varies with the importance of the country. Those commissioners have allocated subjects. They are specialists in their own field. And the whole ground, the whole range of domestic considerations is in the hand of that body. The Commission is the body that makes proposals. And it's very difficult to alter any proposal that is made by the Commission. The Council of Ministers may question, they may raise points and suggest other lines of tactics. But ultimately, the full authority is in the hands of the Commission. The Parliament certainly cannot affect the proposals or the decisions of that body. Ultimately, the power lies in the hands of the President of that Commission. And the authority covers the whole field. If you realize what is involved, the man who is President of that Commission has tremendous power indeed. Take one simple illustration. In the Commission, and in him ultimately, is vested complete control of trade and industry. There is, under the Treaty of Rome, and sometime you ought to read it, is available in paperback form, although it's a mass of words, but under the terms of the treaty, full authority is given to him and to the Commission to rationalize industry. That does not mean merely the introduction of new techniques and processes, but the elimination of duplication, and, if he desires, the centralization of manufacture in certain countries. He could, for example, or the Commission could, and the President ultimately, close down all the factories producing textiles in Belgium and transfer the whole work to France. I'm using rather a foolish illustration. That is the kind of power vested in that body and eventually in the President of the body. I think one ought to appreciate the condition. If you don't see what is happening, you may miss the whole point of the community itself. There is a body which virtually is a supranational power. Oh, we have our own national authority, our national sovereignty, but there is a supranational power. And eventually, quite a great deal of our national power will be subjected to that supranational authority. At the present moment, law is different in various countries, but it is intended in the not too distant future, people have worked on this already, to bring into uniformity the commercial law in every one of those 10 countries. That is a Herculean task. That is why it has taken so long already. But eventually, there'll be a uniform common law right throughout the whole of those countries. The commercial law will be the same in every one of the community countries. But that will go on to common law and civil law. And quite patently, that is going to take rather longer. For example, in this country, a man is innocent until he's proved guilty. In other countries, in certain other countries, he's guilty until he's proved innocent. So that to gain uniformity in that particular field is going to be extremely difficult. But eventually, there will be a complete uniformity in the legal world, in every sphere of law. Not only commercial law, but civil law as well. Criminal law, of course, additionally. You realize the implications again. They are quite serious. Quite a great deal of power is being taken out of the hand, or will be taken out of the hand, of the individual countries concerned, and will be held in the hands of other people. In every field, their central body, the Commission, will have authority. At the present moment, we just look at the basic facts. Import duty has been swept away between the 10, and a common barrier has been erected against other countries, so that the same rate of import duty is levied on goods imported by each one of those countries. The import duty, of course, goes to form the fund that supplies the money for the working of the community. And value-added tax is an additional source of revenue for the community. The same rate of import duty is levied on all goods imported from other countries into those 10. But between themselves, there's no import duty whatsoever. It's an area of free trade. It's a very vast area, 250 million people. The exports from that area are twice those of the United States of America. They are 10 times theirs of Soviet Russia. And the imports are roughly on the same level. Far greater than the imports into America and into Russia. So that there is cause for thinking that here is an advantage to the member countries. They have a very great sphere in which they may trade freely from country to country. Many have said, one couldn't possibly stand on our own feet. This is essential to our commercial well-being. Well, there are arguments on both sides on that question. But here are the present facts. There are other interesting features as well. Over 70%, I think nearly 77%, of the members of the community, or rather of the population of the community, is Roman Catholic. So that quite clearly, the Church is going to have a very strong voice in the councils of Europe. There is no doubt about that. It is already being evidenced at the present moment. And in the coming days, it is perfectly clear that Rome will have a stronger voice in what is being done and what is decided. Now take another glimpse. There is to be complete control, not only of trade and industry, but also of capital and labor. If there is control of trade and commerce, quite patently there must be a control of capital. Where work goes, for example, capital must precede it, so that those in authority who are directing the location of work must have power over capital as well. And secondly, quite obviously, they must have control over labor. It will be possible in a future day to direct workers from one country to go to another. There is provision today for movement between the countries. There are funds that have been set up to alleviate distress and to help workers who do transfer. And there is quite a lot of movement today between country and country. That will increase as time goes on. It may provide a partial solution to the unemployment problems in some countries. On the other hand, it may increase the similar problems in others. Now, I don't think one ought to look to that particular source to solve our own problem, because it is peculiar to our own country. There are factors here which obviously indicate that unemployment is going to be greater rather than smaller. And there's no solution to the problem in the courts of Europe. A complete control of labor. That means also that no one will be employed but by permit of the central authority. And if there's a complete control of capital and a complete control of employers of labor, it means equally as well that no employer will be able to establish a new factory or to employ labor but by permit of the central authority. So that employers will be welded into one. They'll be forced, by the very circumstances, to belong to federations or combinations of employers. On the other hand, employees will be forced to belong to their appropriate bodies, trade unions and professional organizations. Some few years ago, a secretariat for trade unions was set up with this in view. All workers must belong, it was said, to their own appropriate organization. And in the future, not the immediate future, but in the future, it will be impossible to obtain a job unless one is a member of the appropriate trade union or professional organization. It's perfectly clear there's going to be a complete control over labor as well as over capital and employers. Other controls will be exercised as well. It has been said quite plainly, we cannot have 10 different foreign policies within the community. There must be a uniform common policy. United Kingdom at the moment is one of the difficulties in that particular connection. We do like our own way. We like to express our own view and to secure our own ends. And putting it quite frankly, Over the past few years, and particularly over the last 2 years, it has been rather difficult, for Britain has insisted on more than one occasion that her view is the only sensible one. That may be quite justified. I'm not saying it is or it is not. One ought to realize the difficulties that do face the Commission at the moment. But eventually, there must be one common foreign policy, so that that does involve a complete control in that realm. Realize the inference. There has to be not only a control in the commercial world, but in the political world as well. National sovereignty will be subject to that supranational sovereignty. This is utterly inescapable. It's provided for by the Treaty of Rome, and it has been discussed from time to time. And you may recall that an earlier Prime Minister in our own country, Mr. Harold Macmillan, said quite frankly, we've realized that we'll have to surrender our sovereignty to a supranational power. He was only facing the logical position and the utterly inescapable one. There can only be one supreme power in Western Europe or within the community. And that must be, of course, the Commission or any substitute, therefore. Now realize that the Commission eventually comes to one man. The President has the final authority. So that a tremendous authority is held in the hands of that one man. We have been introducing recently in the community a new monetary system, the European monetary system, with the European currency unit as the accounting unit. It is only an accounting unit at the moment. Eventually, it may become a literal currency unit. But it is intended that there should be a common basis and that currencies in various countries should only fluctuate within a certain limit. I think it's between 1.5% and 2.5%, with a very small range. And that will be that will be helped because of the funds that are being raised, the gold and silver, as well as the currencies of those various countries. So that the European currency unit is backed by solid material, virtually by gold and silver. If you pause to think for a moment, the United States dollar has no such backing. Earlier, years ago, it was backed by gold. Today, the dollar has no backing whatsoever. You couldn't go into an American bank and present a $100 note and say, I want $100 worth of gold. The answer would be a polite refusal. In fact, it might not be quite so polite. The dollar today has no gold backing. The European currency unit will have. And if it does become, as is highly probable, the unit, the currency unit for circulation, then you will see a common currency right through those countries. This is one of the reasons for the attitude of the OPEC countries today. They're saying quite deliberately, the price of oil is fixed by the dollar. The dollar fluctuates. It has no solid backing of gold or silver. We cannot trust it. We need something reliable, and we do need a return for our money. The price of oil must provide us with a revenue that we think is reasonable. If we are going to have a reliable basis, it cannot be the American dollar. And it has been said quite frankly, if the European currency unit comes into being, that could possibly be the alternative basis. If you pause to think, you'll realize the implications. Were the American dollar cease to be the basis of pricing of oil, and another unit, another system, be adopted instead, it would destroy to a great extent the credibility of the American dollar. The OPEC countries have already said that the American dollar has irretrievably lost its position of dominance, and one can no longer rely upon it. They're talking now about the vast investment in the financial institutions and banks of the West, and particularly in America. £5,000 million is invested in the West, and the reinvestment of the revenue from oil, or the recycling, as it's termed, of the petrodollar, is one of the biggest financial problems of the present day. For the money that is invested in those institutions is invested on a short-term basis. But those same institutions have to advance money on loan to the third world on a long-term basis. So there is a possibility of disaster if a very large part of that investment is withdrawn. And the Arab powers are talking quite clearly about that possibility. And I don't think one ought to ignore what has been said. Realize that in 1973, the Arab powers realized that economics could be used as a political weapon. And they used it quite clearly and with great effect. The lesson they learned at that time is one, obviously, that they will employ again. And eventually, there's no question whatsoever that economics will come into play in the political realm. And if trouble arises between the Arab powers and the United States, there could be a vast withdrawal of those investments almost overnight. President Carter, of course, tried to stop it in the case of Iran, and he froze the Iranian investments. That would be utterly impossible were the whole of the Arab powers to demand that the investments be restored or withdrawn at their request. So you can see the probability or the possibility of a complete financial chaos. And that could be expedited by the introduction of the European Currency Unit. And that, quite frankly, is going to happen in the not too distant future. So that one ought not to sit down and say, it looks as though we are financially secure. It looks as though things will go on in very much the same old way. Nothing is certain today. Nothing is stable. Nothing is secure. Everything might change overnight, and in the financial realm, almost unquestionably, will. That's only one feature. But the major fact is that the community is, to be the supranational power. Eventually, we will find we'll not be able to pass our own laws, except those that are purely domestic, relate only to our own country. Laws that affect other countries will be subject to an overriding approval, and will in fact be introduced in another sphere prior to the introduction in our sphere. So that the control will be far greater than some people seem to realize. Folk talk today about the possibility of withdrawal from that body. That would be utterly foolish, of course, because the financial consequences would be too great, and the price to pay would be too heavy. On the other hand, we are going to pay a heavy price for our membership of the community. But here we are today in that situation. Well, that's all purely secular, isn't it? And you're probably saying, well, I thought we might be talking about the Bible. And it does seem to me the Bible possibly, or put it the other way round, the events of the present day possibly are a reflection of what is described in the Bible. Do you recall the verses we read together just now from Daniel chapter 7? Had you read from chapter 2, you might have found a rather parallel picture. But taking the two together, Daniel paints the story of the rise of great empires. And he sees four great empires cross the world stage. The Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian, the Grecian, and the Roman. Then he declares another empire will rise, a theocratic empire established by God. And that will have complete dominion throughout the whole world. That, of course, has not yet occurred. But the Roman Empire, the fourth of those four, passed out of being in the year 476. How then can we reconcile Daniel's forecast with what actually is occurring? But other powers have arisen, other powers have crossed the world stage. The Roman Empire is now non-existent. I don't think one ought to sweep the stage quite so clear. The Roman Empire has passed out of being, but today one does see the possibility of something like it coming into being once again. There are some people who say that the European community is a reflection of what the Bible describes. There is something to be said for that view. If you gather together other scriptures as well, Revelation 13 and Revelation 17, you find a strange picture emerging. A great collection of nations, 10 in number, with a supreme dictator, with a different form of administration from any that has preceded it. And you'll find in chapter 17 of Revelation that it is linked with the Roman Empire. But there is it presented in rather curious fashion. John says quite clearly there that there have been various forms of administration in the past. Five forms, he says. He terms them kings. He's referring to kingly or administrative rule. Five forms have existed. A sixth form is now in being. That is, of course, at his time, 19 centuries ago. A seventh form is yet to appear, and then an eighth. The five forms of administration had already passed in the Roman Empire. There had been kings, consuls, dictators, decemvirs, military tribunes, and then at the time he was writing, there was the imperial Caesar form. That prevailed, of course, to the passing away of the great empire. So six forms of administration have now passed away. Five had passed when he was speaking, one was in being, and others were still to come. He says a seventh was to come. And he links the seventh form with the rising of that power of 10 nations under the control of a strong dictator. So he's implying that that form is totally different in character from all that has preceded it. Then he goes on to say that there is an eighth, related also to that same great power. In other words, something occurs between the seventh and the eighth, a change of some kind. Then the eighth, although he's still one of the seven, appears in a different shape or a different form. Now may I backtrack for a moment or two, but keep that in the back of your mind first. You go to Daniel 7, you'll find the 10 nations gathered together under the control of their own rulers. Then quite suddenly, another power arises from their midst, and it is said that he tears up three by the roots, or that he destroys three powers and takes their sovereignty, and becomes then ruler over the other seven. That seems fantastic, doesn't it? But take the present picture. And I'm only using the present picture as an illustration. But take the European community. Here are 10 countries. Three torn up, or three giving their authority to another one. That does seem incredible, doesn't it? Or does it? Three of those 10 formerly worked closely together. Belgium, Holland, and Luxembourg, or the Benelux countries, as they are popularly termed. And today, those same three countries are discussing the desirability of working closely together under the aegis of the European community because of the similarity of their economic and financial problems. If a man arose who is capable of solving those problems, there is no doubt whatsoever that they would give their authority to that man. And of course, if that occurred, other countries in Europe would be equally interested. That's the kind of thing that Daniel described 2.5 millennia ago. And today, it seems that it may occur in the not-too-distant future. Such a man is urgently needed in the Benelux countries. As in Belgium last year, they are, as told, on every side, we're a divided nation. There's a Flemish-speaking part and a French-speaking part. They are really two peoples, bound together quite loosely, with no virtual control in the center. And every side people will say, we are a bankrupt country. There's no future for us unless someone comes to solve the problems and to take control. And frankly, it is just as simple as that. The same, of course, applies to other countries, but particularly to Belgium, the central point of the Benelux power. So there were a man to arise who was capable of filling that position, capable of solving the problems. There's no question whatsoever that they would accept him and give the authority to him. But other countries in Europe are in the same situation. They need someone to take control. One never expected to hear that cry in Western Germany. Western Germany was a prosperous country. Everyone looked to that country and said how fortunate they were. And why is it that Germany is always so fortunate and we, on the other hand, so unfortunate? Germany today is in a complete mess. The Germans are saying quite deliberately, we need a strong man, someone to take control, and someone who can deal with the financial difficulties. Go to France. People are saying, Monsieur Mitterrand proposed all kinds of solutions to our problems. He's offering to spend money in every possible direction. The pouring out so lavishly of money means that our burden is going to be heavier still. And additionally, that the insoluble problem of our economic position is going to become even more insoluble. And the fact is precisely what is said. France today is in vital need of someone to take control and introduce order and to provide a solution to the economic problems. Italy, of course, is in a worse state than almost any country in Europe and is in precisely the same situation. Other countries in Europe, you might say precisely the same thing. Of our own country, well, I suppose I can't talk because there's a lady in charge. But do you imagine for one second that destroying industry and creating unemployment is going to provide a final solution to our economic problems? We may bring down the rate of inflation, although at the present moment the government policy is forcing up the rate of inflation. We may bring down the rate of inflation, but if industry has gone, from whence can come the jobs that men desire? And the prediction today is that the unemployment figure will rise to about 4 million within the next 12 months. The problems seem insoluble. Our economic situation, it seems really beyond human capability to deal with. And Britain, as well as other countries, is in need of someone to take control. Someone with the capacity to deal with difficulties of this kind, to find a solution in the realm of economics and finance. This is the trouble today. There seems no solution to those problems. And Western Europe is in vital need of someone to take control. In past history, whenever there has been need for a man of that character, of any character, the very circumstances have called forth the man who is required. It has happened repeatedly in history. You remember during the last war, we needed a man of a certain caliber to take the lead in our own country. And there's no doubt whatsoever that Sir Winston Churchill was the man raised up for the day. When his work was done, the populace threw him aside, much to his disgust. That's what happens in life today. Right through history, you may find example after example of that character. Whenever there has been need for a man of a certain type, The man has been forced by the circumstances into prominence. Today, in Western Europe, more than at any other time in history, there's need for a man to take control. A man with economic ability and financial understanding, one who can solve the problems and take authority over the countries. There's no doubt whatsoever that because of the lead, the man will arise. And if Daniel's forecast is correct, he will arise first in three countries. Those three will give their authority to him. It seems to line up with what men are anticipating in our present day. Someone in the Benelux countries will have to take control. If that occurs, quite patently, the other countries will accept that same man as their leader also. So that what Daniel described that long time ago seems feasible in our present day. And it might quite easily come through that present body of the European community. May I say, don't go away and say that I've said the European community was the Roman Empire or the revived Roman Empire, for I have said no such thing, and I don't propose to. It's remarkably like it. It's remarkably parallel to what the Bible describes. It might or might not be what the Bible is talking about. Now take the other picture to which we referred in Revelation 17. There, to say quite simply, it will appear, or these nations will appear with their strong ruler as a new form of administration. Well, quite different from any of the six forms that have preceded it in the Roman Empire. But then there comes an eighth, and it's said that he is one of the seventh. We might take it more literally, perhaps. He is actually identifiable with the seventh one himself. What does John mean? If you backtrack through the book, you'll find that there are references to that man, that strong leader, receiving a mortal wound, almost at the point of death, and then suddenly reviving, or perhaps being resuscitated completely. Is John referring to a literal wound, or is he still talking about the vast empire? For he uses the term beast in relation to the empire itself and in relation to the man who controls it, in relation to the 10 countries and to the strong dictator. He may possibly be talking about the man himself, and there are indications that he's referring to a personal wound. But there is a possibility that he's referring to the vast empire itself and not merely to the man. Halfway through that period of 7 years, in Daniel 9 and verse 27, something occurs. That man puts a stop to all forms of religious worship and substitutes the worship of himself. We're told in Daniel that his reign is for 3.5 years, or time, times, and dividing over time. In Revelation, 42 months, 1260 days, and so on. Something happens at the end of that first half of Daniel's 7 years, and the commencement of that last period of 3.5 years. If he claims divinity for himself and worship to be paid to him, as Revelation 13 indicates, then one can understand, for the references to that event also indicate quite clearly that at that point he will be indwelt by the devil. Or putting it figuratively again, he comes up out of the abyss. Is that possibly what John is talking about? Such a complete change in the character of the leader and in the character of administration, that it is quite feasible to refer to it as an eighth form, and yet still as one of the seven. It is still the same empire, still the same collection of nations. The form of administration now is entirely different. It's controlled by one who claims to be divine. Well, that possibly is the track along which we are traveling today. It may or may not be foreshadowed by what is occurring. But certainly what we are seeing today does seem remarkably similar to what the Bible describes. And if you bother to read the Rome Treaty, I think you'll probably come to the conclusion nothing could be more similar than what we are seeing before our eyes today. There is one major difficulty to which I can see no answer. It is possible that Spain and Portugal may become members of the community next year. It is not certain by any means. A few months ago, it was said quite deliberately by a leading spokesman of the European community, we will have 10 full members and no more. The difficulties arising from the adjustments in the economic and financial realm are too great. The changing financially as one country enters the community, changes that affect all the other members, they're far too great to contemplate afresh. Any other countries that apply will become associate members and not full members. He spoke, of course, of his own volition and without official authority. Whether what he said will prevail or not, we don't know. If, however, two other countries enter the community, then you're faced by this question. Can you possibly identify the 10 nations referred to in the Bible with 12 nations in fact? To me, that does seem an insuperable difficulty. If you really want to know the answer to that one, Mr. Beggs will tell you at the end of the meeting. I just don't know. But I think one has to face it. Before you rush off and give another prophetic lecture yourself on the subject of the common market and the revived Roman Empire, and say that the two are identical, realize some of the difficulties that confront you. It may or may not be identical. There are difficulties, and one of the major ones is the probability of the entry of other countries into the community. But taking the picture as it stands, taking the features, quite apart from the possibility of identification, what is happening in the European community today does parallel what is described in the Bible. May I take one simple illustration? I said just now, at least it's a few minutes ago now, that anyone who wanted a job would have to belong to his appropriate body, and he'd be unable to secure a job unless he was a member of his trade union. There will be a completely closed shop. I said also that no employer would be able to employ labor or establish a factory. Bye-bye.